they will not hunger, nor thirst. Neither shall the sun nor heat do them harm, because he who has love for them will lead them, and he will guide them to fountains of life-giving water. That was Isaiah 49:10 from the Ward Green Version, 2003, yours truly. Little Children, the translation I did, that's now about 20 or 21 years ago, Isaiah 49, and that chapter, we're going to see more of Isaiah in today's study, hopefully, but this scripture here, this is important because this is like a prophecy that we see also in Revelation, where it talks about the idea of not hungering or thirsting and not being. But there's also another scripture, I believe it's Isaiah, where it says they will not be sick, is another one, and that's in the book of Revelation also, which was a book, we believe, written by the Apostle John, the book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible. This is Isaiah, which is, he's a major prophet of the Old Testament. Sometime, I guess, we should talk about the prophets and the writers of the books in a little more detail than what we do normally. But we can appreciate the scriptures for what they are without even considering, without considering for a moment who wrote them. They stand on their own merit. Paul, in our study today, at 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 to 8, and we are reading in the article today, the Arca Burartu, the Orient Express, chapter 5, paragraph 4. And so Paul at 1 Corinthians 5, 6 to 8 writes to the Corinthians, quote, "Do you not know that a little leaven ferments the whole lump? A little leaven ferments the whole lump. Keep the festival, but with unfermented cakes," end quote. Leaven is what ferments the bread. It's sometimes we use yeast, of course, to do that. But something that will make, in fact, that's usually what we use if it's going to be fermented. I mean, but I'm not sure what we call it when we use baking soda, if that's called fermentation, but that will also rise, cause the bread to rise. You know, you can use baking soda or baking powder or different things, but yeast is what we use typically as leaven. Did not Solomon himself write more than 1,000 years before? Quote, from Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verse 1, "Dead flies are what cause the oil of the ointment maker to stink, to bubble forth. So a little foolishness does to one who is precious for wisdom and glory." It only takes a little foolishness to spoil all of the wisdom and glory, basically, is what that's saying. Because a little bit of contamination, in other words, dead flies in the oil of the ointment maker, would ruin the whole batch, wouldn't it? It just, you can't separate. Once you've caused something to go bad, or, you know, sometimes you might say something goes rancid sometimes, or in the case of leaven, the bread becomes leavened. We know even with sourdough, you can make sourdough by just exposing flour and water mixed together. The dough can be exposed unleavened to the air, and there's yeast in the air that will leaven the bread if you leave it out long enough. That's sourdough. You can make that without having any yeast. You can use the air, the yeast in the air, to make sourdough. So it's just the same idea. The flies can get in the ointment. You don't have to do it deliberately. It just happens. The flies contaminate the ointment and spoil it. Now, the unfermented cakes are not contaminated with leaven, is what that's saying. From Ezekiel 18 and 4, and again at Ezekiel 18:20, we also read, the soul that is sinning, it itself will die. It's the soul that dies, not just the person's body. The soul dies. Jehovah does not take delight in anyone dying, Ezekiel 18 and 32. We are responsible to warn others of their sin, Ezekiel 3 and 18. Jehovah asks back from us the blood of those who died when we did not speak in order to warn the wicked of their sin. Exodus 20 and 5 says that Jehovah requires exclusive devotion when his people do not worship Jehovah exclusively. Things do happen which are not exactly in accordance with wisdom. And here we quote from Isaiah chapter 3, verses 4 to 12. I shall certainly make boys their princes, and mere arbitrary power will rule over them, and the people will actually tyrannize one over the other, even each one over his fellow man. They will storm the boy against the old man, and the lightly esteemed one against the one to be honored. For each one will lay hold of his brother in the house of his father, saying, you have a mantle, a dictator you ought to become to us, and this overthrown mass should be under your hand. He will raise his voice in that day, saying, I shall not become a wound dresser, and in my house there is neither bread nor a mantle. You men must not set me as dictator over the people. For Jerusalem has stumbled, and Judah itself has fallen, because their tongue and their dealings are against Jehovah, in behaving rebelliously in the eyes of his glory. The very expression of their faces actually testifies against them, and of their sin, like that of Sodom, they do tell. They have not hidden it. Woe to their soul, for they have dealt out to themselves calamity. Say, you men, that it will be well with the righteous one, for they will eat the very fruitage of their dealings. Woe to the wicked one, calamity, for the treatment rendered by his own hands will be rendered to him. As for my people, its task assigners are dealing severely, and mere women actually rule over it. O my people, those leading you on are causing you to wander, and the way of your paths they have confused. End quote. The intense joy of serving Jehovah does not come without a price, but by our giving up all false worship, we may then come to savor, quote, unfermented cakes of sincerity and truth, end quote. Compare with Deuteronomy 6 and 4. And that's the end of our study for today in the Ark of Urartu. As far as the paragraph reading goes, unfermented cakes, there it was, from 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 8. It mentions the unfermented cakes of sincerity and truth. And that's, of course, something that was also celebrated by the Jews during their festival of the unfermented cakes, right? That was something they celebrated during the Passover festival, which was also called the Festival of the Unfermented Cakes, commemorating the exodus of Israel out of Egypt. And all of those events that followed the departure of Israel from Egypt, such as the crossing of the Red Sea, by a miraculous parting of the Red Sea, and something that today is being investigated even more than it was in the past, because people are, with the internet, discovering and publishing information about all of these places, like the archaeological places that have been studied of the place where Israel traveled during their wilderness, you know, wanderings and all of that, but also their departure and their worship as they arrived at Mount Sinai, all of these things. They did do false worship as well. And we have a rather large, I shouldn't say a large group, a rather significant group of people who believe that Mount Sinai is actually in Arabia on the east of the Gulf of Aqaba, and that the crossing of the Red Sea was over the Gulf of Nueva on the eastern arm of the Red Sea. And that's certainly an interesting theory, because it has a lot of interesting evidence associated with it, such as the more than the idea, it's not just an idea, the evidence that they found with the chariot, they found chariot wheels underwater in that stretch of water there, that indicates there was a large, evidently large body of chariots that went through there before it was washed away by the water, you know, drowned, before the Egyptians were drowned, in other words, is the idea that they believe they've discovered the actual site. And it's backed up by the fact they found two columns on either side of that body of water, which were erected by King Solomon, that marked the crossing of the Red Sea in Solomon's time, that commemorating that crossing in the days of Moses. So, you know, the thing is, you know, I mean, when we talk about King Solomon, right, I mean, there are obviously dates, like we see from the Bible, Solomon ruled Israel for 40 years. Therefore, we understand the relative dates, 40-year difference between the beginning of Solomon and the beginning of his son, Rehoboam, was a relative, you know, period of time that we know, relative, the one relative to the other. We know those numbers from the Bible, but the Bible doesn't give us the absolute dates, right? I mean, it just doesn't do that. So, you know, but does that mean there was no absolute date? Obviously, that doesn't seem right. If it really happened, there has to be an actual date when these things happened. It must have been on a precise year in the scheme of time, you know. It must have happened in an exact year. So that's what we've done. But if you position that year wrongly, then all the previous and all the succeeding years become out of alignment with reality. So that's what the genealogy has been attempting to do, is align everything and make it possible that everything can be consistent. And if you look at the other people's chronologies, how many of them have attempted to do what the genealogy does? I mean, you need to answer that for yourself, I think. But we have attempted to encompass all of history, which is really from, you know, the beginning of writing, essentially, is where history begins. We don't have any other, or the beginning of civilization, right? That's where, that's actually where history begins. But the history itself really is only documented by the writing. So it's got to do with when writing began. Deuteronomy 6 and 4 says, "Listen, O Israel, Jehovah our God is one Jehovah." Wow. See, there's an interesting, it's far more than interesting, it's powerful, and it's important. If Jehovah's one Jehovah, then how do you reconcile that with the idea of the teaching of the Trinity that some people preach and teach? Does the Trinity make any sense if Jehovah's one Jehovah? Well, the teachers of the Trinity will say, oh, sure, it just means that, you know, the triune God is one God. They're saying there's three gods, but that because the three gods are all one God, there's only one God. They somehow can try and rationalize that scripture and still believe the Trinity, but it doesn't seem to indicate anything about a Trinity to say there's only one God. There's one God. Not, if there were three gods, it wouldn't say there's one God. You would say there are three gods in one or something, wouldn't it, in that scripture? It wouldn't say Jehovah's one Jehovah. I mean, how can that prove the Trinity? Obviously, it can't. It's proof against the Trinity. And many other things also are proof against the Trinity, but that's one classic example against the Trinity. He's one God. Why does it say he's one God? There's got to be a reason why it says that. In the chart at the end of the paragraph, this is an interesting chart. I have myself looked at it only very briefly during all of my studies, but it's a summary of the Great Pyramid. Among other information here, it gives the outer diameter of the Great Pyramid, I should say. The Great Pyramid, what is the outer diameter of, and the inner diameter of what? That I just noticed now, the 11,000. I don't know what that is. But if you look at the base, the circumference at the level of the base of the pyramid is given here. What the units are, what's it given in? What are the units? Does it even say how many, I mean, what the units are? It gives 36,000, but what is the, what is that? 36,000 what? Cubits? Feet? Wouldn't be meters, I wouldn't think, but don't know. Square circuit at level MN, that's the circumference at some point above the base of the Great Pyramid at the height of 1702 and a half, whatever that number of units is, whatever that unit is, whatever the number, whatever units that number represents, how many units, or how many, we know how many it is, but what the units are, whatever those units are, somebody would have to tell us somewhere. But this diagram would be really worth looking at. It appears to me a very interesting sketch here, and of course it's not the most up-to-date measurements at all. It's a very old very old table, a plate from a book. I'm sure I mentioned what book it's from somewhere here also in the article here. Where is it from? Well, it's from the Great Pyramid, it's Divine Message, right? So we've been looking at that drawing. Let's just see for a moment here. In table A, to the right of the drawing of the pyramid, Oh, look at this. Wait a minute now. The circumference, right? What's the outer diameter and the inner diameter? Wow. Oh, it's the diameter of this circle. Oh, these are... These are... This is the circumference of a circle that's actually equal to the circumference of the base. And they've drawn the circle of the same circumference in the drawing here and shown how it intersects with the pyramid in different places, right? It's fascinating. Outer diameter, inner diameter. I'm going to have to study that more. I want to know what they're saying there. It's fascinating. We might be able to discover something new, important, and brand new there if we look at it. But if you look at the table to the right, you see all the chronologies of Manetho, but also there are... It says here what it gives the rulers of Egypt prior to the dynasties of humans, which were dynasties of gods, there by Manetho also, and their totals are added up. 8 gods who existed before the rest, 12,000 years total. The gods of the second order, 6,846 years. The third order of gods, 5,813 years. And then you get into the dynasties and the total number of years of dynasties, according to Africanus, in the different editions of Africanus, either 5,601 or all the way down to 5,349 in the case of the smaller one. Smallest of those totals for Africanus. 5,000 years of Egyptian dynasties, we know that's not right, because at least not from what we believe, that even the higher estimates that say that Egypt existed as far as old as 3,000 years BC, that since Egypt ended in 343 BCE, the last king of Egypt. The number 343, by the way, is just equal to 7 times 7 times 7. But it's the date 343 BCE when the last king of Egypt, Pharaoh, the last Pharaoh, ended his rule. His rule ended then. So from 3000 to 343 can't be more than 3,000 years. So 5,600 is too much. For Africanus, Eusebius gives his totals, or he didn't give these. These are just the versions that we have that were passed down from Eusebius, as best we can tell. They give 4,600 and something, or maybe a little less, total years for the dynasties of Egypt. Suetus gives 4,650, and Castor. But actually, Suetus gives 4,650 for the gods and the kings together. Castor gives for the dynasties 1 through 18. That's only 1 through 18. The numbers we just gave were for dynasties 1 through 31 for Africanus and Eusebius, between 5,600 and 4,600, basically, for the two accounts from Africanus and Eusebius respectively. We know it can't be that much, because it should be in our chronology from 27 something to 343. It's only 2400 years. But Castor gives from dynasty 1 to 18, 3700. So different, and that's got to be too many also, according to what we, you know, what we use in our chronology, what we've given. But, you know, could anyone else be right? Well, if they're right, it would invalidate not just the Egyptian history that we gave, but it also would invalidate everything else in our chronology, including the time of Abraham and all. So all the things that we accounted are part of the chronology of history, right? Everything's a part of the overall chronology. It all fits together. And you can try to change part of it if you are interested in trying that, but what you will find is it will cause you to lose out on some other part. Or at least that's the danger. If you can account for everything, then that's good, right? If you can do it with a different chronology than what we have, and if it works better than the chronology we have, well, that's good. But we don't know of any better chronology than what we have. But look at the old chronology of Egypt. That's, or the old chronicle of Egypt. There it mentions that as well. That's fascinating. Because it gives the 15 generations of Sothic cycle, 443 years. We talk about that in the articles, definitely. The 15 generations of the Sothic cycle, and look at all these totals. So if we exclude the divine dynasties, 36,000, there is something like 2,324, isn't it? 2,324. That's remarkable. Because we have 36,000, if we take the total, so that actually agrees with our chronology. I don't even know if I actually did this. I think I did this calculation at some point. I do believe that I saw this. This is what partially, you know, encourages us and partially reinforces or confirms, you know, or solidifies to a great degree. What do we want? 34,201 is the first number given, right? We've got to subtract that. The dynasties of the gods. Subtract that, we get 2,324, like I said. Add that, okay, to 343, the end of the last pharaoh, BCE years. 2,667 would be the beginning of the Egyptian rulership, if that were true. That's not too far different from the old kingdom that began in 2,682, right? It's not very different at all. But we also have, you know, added to that 69 years of Nimrod or something to get back. If we take the 69 years as ending in 2680, then if we added 69 to that, we'd get 2749, which is the birth of Peleg. And it was said in the Bible that in the days of Peleg, the earth was divided, right? That fits beautifully with our chronology. If by the days of Peleg, they mean the early days when he was a baby, like the very first days of Peleg. If that was the time when the earth was divided, then that would be, in our chronology, exactly 2749, according to the Septuagint Bible and the generations given there. 2749 were the earliest days of Peleg. If that was when the earth was divided, then, you know, if we take the 69 years of Nimrod from the Kitab al-Magal, which is just a number that was seen as being the difference that we calculated between the place where the Narmer Pallet was found and Noah's Ark site in the mountains of Ararat, that was the difference in time for the rising of Sothis between those two locations was 69 years. But and that also is the number given as the number of years that Nimrod ruled according to the Kitab al-Magal. So if we subtract 2749 minus 69, we get 2680, which, by the way, happens to be almost exactly the beginning of the Old Kingdom, according to what used to be what Wikipedia said. Anyway, I haven't attempted to save their page, but we better save it right now before they change it. They're always changing it, because they don't want us to be correct, it seems. Well, they're saying 2686 right now. Yeah, I've seen it as, you know, you can say 26. So 2680, 2686, it's not much different, is it? For the beginning of Old Kingdom. Let's just save it right now. Export this while we're at it. That's it. Okay. Just want to make sure I make a note of it. Save it before somebody changes it. And that's it for today's study, isn't it? Not really. I mean, a couple of minutes, yes. In a minute or two. It's the end of our study. But, you know, I mean, we're struggling to understand these ancient dates from as many different viewpoints as we can, because we have so little information. There's so little available information that we look at everything. So the old Chronicle of Egypt, like if you look at, yeah. I mean, while we have a little bit of time, let's do a little bit. Like if you look at Waddell, the 1940 book by Waddell called, what's it called? Manetho, an English translation, I think it is. Yeah. And also he's got Ptolemy and other things. But Manetho, an English translation he's got. And then at the end of the Manetho dynasties, which he has, if we go, where is it? It's called Egyptica, by the way. The work of Manetho, compiling all the dynasties, was called Egyptica. That's Ptolemy. There's the Book of Sothis, right. So the Book of Sothis, that was one thing that we've seen, and but there are other books here too. Let me see. I think it's before the Book of Sothis, maybe. Yeah. So we've got to go back prior. In Waddell's book, this is all part of Waddell's 1940 book. The old chronicle right here precedes the Book of Sothis. See, and he gives, in the old chronicle, there are numbers given for the dynasties, how many years. The Sothic cycle, 15 generations, is given as 443 years. You see, so there's all of that is worth looking at, and because we have so little information, and I did look at all of this at some point in the articles. I looked at these numbers, and I used these numbers as well as I could at the time. And probably if we reevaluate, or if we get more information and reevaluate, or both, anything. And here's a list of the, it's called Eratosthenes, the list of the books of the kings of Thebes, according to what is said to be Eratosthenes, but it's not even clear what the source is. So they're the kings of Thebes also. It says 1124 of the Theban kings after the dispersion. Years of kings. That's it for today's study. It's October 24th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 20:28 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. Thank you so much for listening and watching, and I love you very much. In my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying bye for now. We've been studying the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express, and we today looked at Chapter 5,